And I'm not even, this is informal. So please, I'm going to tell you what, right. I asked, since there wasn't a speaker this week, I just wanted to tell you about some work in progress. So although I guess it's being recorded, I also like, please treat this as sort of a group meeting discussion, interrupt me, whatever. Also, I will try to repeat any question that comes from the live audience, because I think the online people cannot hear the live people. Okay. Right, so what I want to tell you about is, also I have no idea how big I'm supposed to write on this board. I want to tell you about algebraically closed higher categories. And is that legible or no?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is everything I'm going to tell you is joint with David Reuter. And everything is very much in progress. Had I given this talk yesterday, I would tell you some things that are going to be like completely disagreeing with things I'm going to tell you today. So like, take that with a big grain of salt. Okay, so yes. So what is a? What do I? Okay, I'm not going to try to like. So let me since maybe you don't know what an algebraically closed lower category is, let me remind you a little bit about just a little bit of abstract algebra from, you know, maybe a first year PhD course or advanced undergrad course. So let me remind the zero categorical story. And this will let me kind of make a correction already. So in the theory of algebraic closures is about the theory of fields. Or maybe about the theory of like commutative division rings, which are the same as fields, but maybe generalized in a slightly different mindset. If you start with a field, an algebraic closure of K is, well, it should be a field extension A into K bar. And it should be kind of, I want it to be a sort of universal object for finite dimensional field extensions. If you take any K into L finite dimensional field extension, then you can fit L inside of K bar. And lastly, I don't want it to be too large. Like, you could do this by sort of vastly overestimating the size of K bar needs to be. So let's ask that K bar be not too large. Let's say that this is, it's probably not a finite dimensional extension, but let's say that it's an IND finite dimensional extension. Meaning that if you run through all of the finite dimensional subfields of k-bar and take their union, you actually get k-bar. So k-bar is built out of its finite dimensional subpieces. That's what an algebraic closure would be. And that's the sort of notion I want to tell you about in higher categories. And I'm already going to make a few sort of modifications to this. So there's some places where you can make some choices for what you want to do. So instead of talking about, say, finite dimensional extensions, You could restrict attention a little bit further. It won't make a difference in characteristic zero, but it might make a difference in positive characteristic. So a separable closure would be where in every time you saw finite dimensional, you replace it by finite dimensional and separable. And that's actually the notion I want to tell you about today. So this is the general framework. Of course, algebraic closures, separable closures, are the sort of bread and butter of Galois theory. These were invented pretty much by Galois in order to study solutions to polynomial equations. And the reason why I think that I'm just going to focus on separable closures is because in Galois theory, that's good enough for Galois theory. The difference between separable and algebraic closures is sort of invisible to Galois groups. It's important, but it's invisible to Galois groups. So before I go on to the n-category version, let me just tell you some facts about algebraic closures that are basically due to Hilbert. So there's going to be some things that I'm going to call kind of Nullstellensätze. There are various Nullstellensätze, and at various strengths. So Hilbert pointed out that k-bar is the field is algebraically closed. If and only if, and there's at least two different kind of ways you could characterize algebraic closures, in addition to this sort of thing about just testing its field. See, here I basically said you look at all field extensions. Well, that might be a hard notion to work with because being a field requires division, and division is really hard to deal with. So rather than testing just against field extensions, I could test against more objects than that. So K is algebraically closed if and only if. For every non-zero finite dimensional K algebra, say it that way, doesn't matter. For every finite dimensional K algebra, and all of my algebras are going to be commutative, I'm going to sort of say two versions. There's a kind of weak Nullstellensatz, which says that for every finite dimensional K algebra, let's call it, I don't know, A, if A is not the zero algebra, then Hom from A to K is not empty. And there's a sort of strong Nullstellensatz, which says that actually Hom from A to K pretty much recovers A. And now for this to actually be correct, I really should work with separable closures. So let's say finite dimensional. You know, you could do this for lots of different versions, as I said. You could replace finite dimensional with sort of finite dimensional separable, or just finitely generated, or there's lots of different versions of Nullstellensatz so that you could have. The word Nullstellensatz that has to do with zero, it means something about zero set. It's like zero set theorem. So the way you're supposed to read this type of statement is that the finite dimensional K algebra or the finitely generated K algebra, you look at the generators, you look at the equations they solve in this ring. Those are some polynomial equations. A morphism from A to K bar is a solution to those polynomial equations. So it's a zero set of some set of polynomials. And the Nullstellensatz are saying that if you give you a set of polynomials, then it has to have solutions. Yeah, So I didn't say it correctly. Let's see, here's a correct statement. K is separably closed if for every finite dimensional and separable K algebra. For every finite dimensional separable commutative K algebra, it has a K point, and now I can tell you what pretty much recovers A means. I mean, well, there's always a map from A to the functions on this Hom set. The K bar valued functions on the Hom set. This is easy. You just take any elements of A, take any homomorphism from A to K bar, and evaluate. And I want to ask that this map is an ISO. And I can recover the separable closure if I run that over just separably, separable finite dimensional algebras, for example. And I'm going to add one more version of the Nullstellen sets in a moment. OK. So this is the notion I want to generalize, as I said. So I'd like to take this, and I'd like to look at it for not commutative algebras, but for symmetric monoidal higher categories. So my strategy is going to be to replace commutative algebra by symmetric monoidal K-linear N category. I think from here on out, I'm always going to fix somewhere eventually I'm going to need to be working in characteristic zero, so I might as well fix that. It won't matter for what I'm going to say yet, but I think it will in a moment. Okay. So I'm going to replace commutative algebra by K-linear higher category. I don't really know what the right notion of finite dimensional algebra is, or finitely generated algebra is. In the theory of field extensions, what you really care about is when an extension is, quote, algebraic. An extension is algebraic if every point in the target of the extension solves some polynomial with coefficients in the base. Now, if you're over a field, being algebraic is exactly the same as being indefinite dimensional. But over a ring, that's not. And commutative algebra, sort of higher categories don't feel very much like fields. They feel more like rings, exactly because it's hard to divide. And so I really shouldn't be talking about finite dimensional extensions. I should be talking about algebraic extensions, and that requires really thinking about what polynomials are. And I don't really know what those are except for in low dimension. So I'm not going to worry about that. I'll just work with separable. So the version of finite dimensional separable algebras the correct version of finite dimensional separability that I'm going to use is the commutative, as I said, is symmetric. And finite dimensional separable I'm going to use will correctly generalize to what you might call multifusion. And I saw in the Zoom chat that Bibadeau was here. So in when n is roughly 1, we know that all multifusion categories are separable in characteristic 0, and probably that's true in for all n. So otherwise, I should really say separable. So that will be my generalization of multifusion. And I think I should probably tell you what those words mean. And I don't really want to erase my Nullstellen sets yet. So Right, so let me tell you the definition of multifusion. So, so let's see. So, so an N category, in category C, is multifusion if, let's see. And as I said, it won't really matter that I'm talking about symmetric monoidal categories here. The same notion makes sense in general. And it's going to be, it's actually, it turns out to be a really useful notion. It's multifusion if it has the following. So it should be linear. Or maybe k bar linear. Maybe I'm just going to work over, maybe I'll just fix an algebraically closed base from here on out. It's linear. It should be additive. It should have direct sums. And it should be Kurubi complete. And by Kurubi complete, this is a notion that we worked out with Gallodo. There's a sort of this kind of in the N categorical sense that I'm not going to explain right now. It turns out that there's a theory of Kurubi complete N categories that exactly parallels the theory of Kurubi complete 1 categories. And then it should have all duals. It should be sort of rigid. So that means that all objects and kind of morphisms have duals or adjoints. So it should be the type of N category where you can probe it using, say, the methods of topological field theory. And the last, let's see, I want two more conditions. I want it to be, if you know what a multifusion 1 category is, you know that there's somehow the most important parts of being a multifusion 1 category is that you're semi-simple with finitely many simple objects. And those are the conditions I want to impose. So I'd like to ask that this, that if I have an N category, then the spaces of N minus 1 morphisms form regular old 1 categories. So I want to say all the 1 categories of N minus 1 morphisms are semi-simple. And the last thing I need to do is put in some finiteness. And I'm going to keep trying to write lower on the board, unless somebody tells me they can't see. So if you are in a setting where you have really good rigidity and really good Kurubi completion and really good semi-simplicity, you get a very strong notion of a kind of Schur's lemma. Where can I don't really want to. No, I'm going to write it here, just because I don't want to hunch too much. So I just want to, before I finish the definition, I need to tell you one more thing about semi-simple N categories. So, so these three conditions together you might think of as being what it is to be a semi-simple N category. Somehow existence of adjoints for one morphisms feels like part of the, when you sort of try to figure out what does it feel like to be a semi-simple higher category, it ends up feeling like having adjoints feels right. So at least, maybe there's a stronger statement than this, but at least it's true for semi-simple categories. So remember that in a one category, if you have a map is a non-zero map between simple objects, this is Schur's lemma. Schur says that in a one category, if you have a map which is non-zero and between and both the source and target are simples, then it's an ISO. This completely fails as soon as you get to semi-simple two categories. It just fails immediately in two categories. But what is true in two categories is it's not an ISO, but the correct statement is that then F is both injective and surjective. Is both injective and surjective. It's both sort of what you might call a strong injection and a strong surjection. By strong, I'll say what these words mean. By strong, I mean that the following. I mean that there's monomorphism is called a strong mono if it has a. These are like statements of the form that have a one-sided inverse. So what I really mean by this is I mean that that F is the so the strong mono, for instance, is that F is the inclusion. Kind of, I almost want to say onto a direct sum end, which is not quite correct. Let's say it this way. So for example, here it means that Y carries an idempotent. With image X. So it's the image of a projection. And it goes in both directions. Also, X carries an idempotent with image Y. And F is the projection. So it's both the projection onto a subobject and the injection of a subobject. So because of this Schur's lemma, what turns out is that when you're studying higher categories, it turns out to be very helpful to talk about. It turns out that you can say that there is an equivalence relation. Let's say that simple objects, let's say that two simple objects are connected. If there exists a map, a non-zero map between them. And because of this sort of Schur calculus that makes sense in higher categories, what turns out is that the corollary is that this notion of connectedness, the corollary says that connectedness is an equivalence relation. On simples. And for many, many applications, it turns out this is the correct equivalence relation that generalizes, not for all of them, but for many cases, this is the thing, the kind of connected components are what you should think of. If you did something in one categories where you cared about the set of isomorphism classes of simple objects, in n categories, what turns out to be a useful notion is the connected components. Yes. No, because I didn't tell it to you for the first time. So I cannot repeat it. I can. Yes, I can say exactly what it is. If you will grant me, it's very easy to detect simplicity if I'm in this kind of locally semi-simplicity world. If I'm locally semi-simple, then I can always decompose objects into direct sums of simple objects, and semi-simple, and simple is the same as indecomposable under direct sums. In general, if I don't have some local semi-simplicity, I'd have to think a little bit. I think if I don't have local semi-simplicity, then I want an object to be simple if every functor out of it is. Is mono. Oh, this is called local semi-simplicity because I only asked a question about, like, in category theory, you say that a category is locally X, like a category is locally orange if all the HOM sets are orange. So that's why the word local. It means that like it's some adjective you apply to the Hom spaces. Anyway, in this very semi-simple world where my Hom n minus one categories are simple or semi-simple, then simple is exactly the same as indecomposable under direct sums. Yeah, so I should have said in a let me just take these as being the definition of semi-simple n category. Yeah, they mean they're as good as you could ever have them to be. Well, they're better than abelian categories. They're not just abelian categories. They're semi-simple categories. Semi-simple categories are this like intersection between abelian categories and Caribbean categories. And they're the one world where it doesn't really matter which, like, somehow you could develop, like, the theory of semi-simple categories is so much easier than the theory of abelian categories. They're so much better behaved. You never had to invent abelian categories to talk about them. You never had to invent, like, you know, modules that weren't projective or something like that. So I think there's a much stronger statement here than that I haven't said, but I'm not sure what it is. So anyway, I wanted to finish the definition of multifusion. So because I have a good notion, so the corollary, as I said, is that although objects can be connected by a non-zero map, even if they're not isomorphic, it's still the case that being connected is an equivalence relation. And so I'll write pi 0 of C. So if C, maybe C was my n category, to be the equivalence classes of this relation. And it really does feel like the connected components of a topological space. And so the last condition I want for multifusion is I'll say that a category is multifusion if, well, yeah, as soon as you know what pi 0 is, then you also know what all the higher homotopy type groups are. Because I could write pi k of C, I could define as saying that that's pi 0 of, well, I'm in a symmetric monoidal category, so I could, I need one more good notation. I could take C. C, because it's symmetric monoidal, it has an identity element in it, which you should think of as like the base point of this element. As soon as you have a base point, then you can talk about the base loops at that base point. So I can loop the category k times. So this is, by definition, this is like the endomorphisms of 1 inside the endomorphisms of 1 inside the endomorphisms, like the endomorphisms of the in the endomorphisms k times. Let me write it. You can figure it out by induction. By omega c, I mean the endomorphism category in C of the unit object. This is again monoidal, so you can do it again. Okay, so then I want to ask that these all be finite. These are just sets. They're not groups or anything. In spite of the fact that I called them homotopy groups, they're not groups, they're just sets. I want to ask them to be finite. So that's going to be my definition. And now I can give you the definition of separably closed, and now I'll just round it up. So let's say a symmetric one of these, a symmetric multifusion n category, a symmetric multifusion n category V is separably closed if for every kind of sort of say V linear symmetric multifusion N category then three different possible conditions. First of all, you could ask about a weak condition. You could just say, are the Hom spaces inhabited? That's like a weak null-Stollen Satz. Let me call it Vn because it's an N category. You could ask a strong version. Well, the maps between symmetric multifusion N categories, that's some N groupoid. So this is always going to be some N groupoid. And I could ask that it recovers my test object. And I could ask the same thing. I could, there's just automatically going to be a map from the test object to that object. And I could ask that this be an isomorphism, an equivalent, I mean, a home, you know, a weak equivalence of N groupoids. And now I'm going to ask one other version of it, which is that there's, you could ask this sort of same question in the homotopy category, a kind of universal property. So implicitly, I'm using the fact that symmetric multifusion N categories, among other things, form an infinity one category. I know what it talks about, what it means to talk about symmetric monoidal maps between them, and they form a space. They might form more than a space, but they certainly form a space. So what I can do is I can look at this same thing. I can look at Hom from A to Vn. As I said, that's some N groupoid. And I can take just it's the underlying set. So I can take the homomorphisms in the homotopy category of multifusion N categories. And well, if I have any symmetric monoidal map from A to Vn, then in particular, I get a map from the kind of N morphisms in A, to the N morphisms in V. So I'd get a map from the N morphisms in A. This is just some commutative ring. In fact, some separable commutative ring. And just down to whatever ground field I'm working over. And I could ask that this be an iso. And it's not at all obvious that these three conditions are, give you the same characterization. These are like three different versions, but I'm going to try to tell you that they're actually, that there is one of these objects and that these, each of these conditions specifies the algebraic closure. This does do that. This is actually, this universal property is kind of a field-like property. Being a field, what is it to be a field? To be a field means that if you have, so being a field is like the fact that if you're a separable algebra, let me just talk about separable commutative algebras and not worry about nilpotent stuff at all. If you're a separable algebra, the thing that distinguishes the fields from the other things is that the fields are exactly the things that are atal connected, or their spectrum is atal connected. Atal connectedness is something that you test with exactly this type of mapping space. An algebraically closed field is something that's not just atal connected, but atal simply connected. So which is also one of these. And this is a sort of goes higher and higher. It keeps imposing that higher and higher atal homotopy groups vanish. So actually, being a field is just the zeroth of a sequence of conditions, of which the first one is algebraic closure that you're used to. So a big part of what we've done recently with David was really to sort of understand that these properties are the right ones for algebraic closure. And in particular, to understand that there is such an object that represents this functor C. I won't tell you this, because I really want to tell you a little bit about the algebraic closure, about this kind of curly V. I want to tell you sort of some of its flavor. And in particular, I want to tell you about its Galois group. And I'm not sure if I'll have enough time, but. So rather than telling you why these exist, let me just say it really quickly. So as soon as you can write down an algebraic property like a universal property like this, this is some property that characterizes V in the homotopy category, homotopy 1 category of symmetric monodal n categories. So to convince you that such a Vn exists, all I have to do is here's some specific functor, some specific presheaf on this category. It's the presheaf that's any test object A assigns this set. This is just a presheaf in the usual sense of 1 categories. So all I have to do is I have to convince you that this presheaf is representable, or at least indrepresentable. Now, a presheaf is indrepresentable exactly when it takes when it takes finite colimits to limits. So to test if this is indrepresentable, all I have to do is test how does this particular functor behave under finite colimits in the A spot. And there's not very many finite colimits, and you understand them. They're just generated by like pushouts or something like that. So you just test basically you just work out what does this do to pushouts of symmetric monoidal n categories. And then you see that it works. So there must be one of these. So now the question is only once you know it exists, once you know an object exists, it becomes really easy to study it because you know it exists. You just have to like calculate about it. So now let me just sort of tell you some facts about this Vn. The first fact is that there's some really shallow facts that you can just write off immediately. If you let n vary, before I even do this, let me tell you one example. So of course, V0 is just the algebraic closure of my ground field. V1, is the category of supervector spaces. And the Null-Stollensatze there, this is basically a theorem of Deligne's. The Null-Stollensatze these kind of basically are exact translation. The way we discovered, sort of the way what drew our attention to these is that this is exactly the theory of super-Tanakhian duality. Once I tell you the universal property for it, it has to be unique up to non-unique isomorphism. Actually, up to unique isomorphism, but up to non-unique next isomorphism. Like, it's unique in the homotopy category. It does. It really bothered me exactly for this reason for a while. Yeah, so what happens is that Vn is, there is a Galois group. There's like, Vn has automorphisms. The Galois group is some like higher group. Once I tell you which algebraic closure I want to be in the bottom, I've pinned the kind of zeroth component of the Galois group. So Vn, because I have a universal property, it implies that any two Vns are isomorphic, and any two isomorphisms which are the same on kind of k-bar are homotopy, like are equivalent isomorphisms. But there might be equivalences of equivalences. Yes, that follows from this universal property. I mean, really, what I should do is I should have just written down the universal property first, and then recovered all these other properties from. Like this is the strongest one compared to the other two. I mean, I sort of snuck in one extra thing here. The first two things were about like anybody which was Vn. And here I'm sort of deciding, what am I really deciding here? I'm really deciding that here I guess I've already chosen a look for Vn so that V, if you take sort of loops n, Vn should be k bar. I've sort of chosen that when I wrote down that universal property. And that's what pins the uniqueness. So it's as unique or not as the algebraic closure was in ordinary Galois theory. So anyway, I won't spell this out in detail, but I'll just flag that like this weak universal property, this weak Null-Schillingsatz is exactly Dillean's existence of superfibre functors. And this strong one is exactly the theory of super-Tanakian duality. It says that you can recover a symmetric monomial category from its fibers. This is called a fibre functor, is a functor here. It says you can recover a category from its fibre functors, from its group of fibre functors. And the way you recover it is exactly this formula. That's what super-Tanakian duality tells you. In vector spaces, not everything has a fiber into vector spaces. So vector spaces might be too small. This set of functors might miss things. Dillean shows that any symmetric monomial category, which is sort of an algebraic extension of vec, has a functor to supervec. There are categories which are too large to have a functor to supervec. Just like there are. Yeah, well, I give a much stronger definition. I'm only testing against multifusion, which is much stronger than Dillean requires. Yes, every symmetric fusion category has a functor to supervector spaces. That's a sort of relatively easy consequence of the harder version that Dillean proves. What's really going on is that Dillean actually proves, as I said, I sort of said this in words at the beginning. You know from ordinary Galois theory that there's a difference between separable extensions and algebraic extensions. And what we've by now understood is that Dillean's condition for existence of fiber functors is precisely that the extension be algebraic. And I'm only testing against separable things. Now it turns out in characteristic zero, after Dillean's work, we know what the algebraic closure is. And we know it matches the separable closure. So it's sort of a statement in characteristic zero that vec is perfect. In positive characteristic, Ostrich has pointed out that vec is not perfect in positive characteristic. So I really want to be in characteristic zero for this. So let me give some other immediate properties, and then I'm going to run myself out of time. So this V bullet, it is a what you might call a categorical loop spectrum. So normally in algebraic topology, a spectrum, a loop spectrum, is this fact that if you take Vn, well, a symmetric monomial, so it has a base point, you could take the loops of it. That's some n minus 1 category. And it is just Vn minus 1. And that just follows from this universal property. In fact, let me sort of, yeah. And another universal fact that this follows from this is that if you take any symmetric monomial category, an interesting question you can ask about a symmetric monomial category, just like an interesting question you can ask about a commutative ring, is what's its group of units? An interesting question you can ask about a symmetric monomial category is what's its space of invertibles, of invertible objects and invertible morphisms and so on. So you can take this V, this sort of higher category V, and you can take the invertibles, the group of invertibles. This is some higher group of invertibles. And also from this universal property, it just immediately follows that this group is a group that people have studied for a long time. This is a group called the Pontryagin dual to spheres, IK cross. This might not be a very meaningful thing for you. This is some, what is this thing? This is some higher group. It's actually a sequence of higher groups. So in particular, what I'm telling you is that the invertible objects in Vn, if you take invertible objects up to so I'm going to start calling something else. I might call this like inv Vn. So you take this whole n category. It had lots of things. It has lots of different objects. All of them are invertible. Some of them are connected but not isomorphic. You take just the invertibles and just the isomorphisms between them. That's some set. And you look at just those objects up to isomorphism. So when I said that it was dual to spheres, what I really mean is that this as a group, this is just an ordinary group, and it is the group. It is the group, which is what you get by taking the nth stable homotopy group of spheres, so the nth homotopy group of the sphere spectrum. Let me write it this way. So you take the sphere spectrum, which is some sort of quite complicated object from algebraic topology. You take its nth homotopy group, and you take its the dual group. So maybe I'll write a wide hat to mean kind of into k bar, into the group of units of k bar. So what I'm telling you is that these algebraically closed higher categories, they are the categorical, the thing that has non-invertible things in it, extension of the dual to spheres. This dual to spheres is, for instance, features heavily in the reflection positivity work of Hopkins and Fried. That's one of the reasons we were looking at it. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it won't be too hard, but I haven't actually written down all the details of the argument. So I sort of said in words how to prove its existence. You inspect the right-hand side of this functor, and you just have to show that this functor is representable, or indrepresentable rather, which just means checking some statement about colimits. Yeah, I was worried about that too. It turns out it is enough. No, I mean what you do is this universal property tells you exactly what Vn is in the homotopy category of higher categories. And so but once you have an object in the homotopy category, it must have come from an object in the infinity category. So oh yeah, this one's really easy. Here I ran over all separable extensions of V. Among the separable extensions of V are the ones that are basically group algebras. You take an abelian group, except that the version of abelian groups in this world is spectra. You take not all spectra, but a finite spectrum. You form the corresponding group algebra, and then you read off what the universal property says for that group algebra, and you find it exactly says this. Mapping from a group algebra is just mapping into the units of the target. So it is exactly, this is just an exact version of the universal property. I think I have, 5, 10 more minutes? Is that right? Okay, five minutes then. So these were shallow things. Now I want to tell you a deep thing. And I won't be able to tell you everything. And I want to say, if you read my abstract, please forget what you read in the abstract of this talk, because I said something wrong in the abstract. So the last thing that you need to do is you actually need to calculate this Vn. I've told you about it. I've told you what its units are, for instance. But you need to actually calculate it. So. Well, what you can do is I told you that you could take sort of the loops Vn. We already know that. That was sort of the n minus first one of these. So I'll build it inductively. Now, the functor of taking loops has an adjoint, which I'm going to call suspension. So there's loops is adjoint to suspension. There's an adjunction between taking loops and what I'm going to call suspension. Suspension is literally, you take this as the one object delooping. So suspension is a thing that takes an n minus 1 category to an n category. And what it is literally is you take the one object delooping, and then you Karubi complete that. That's how you build this suspension functor. I was telling you that the functor of taking loops is adjoint to a functor called suspension. Oh, I told you what the functor of suspension was. It was the way you build the suspension is you take the one object delooping. So you take your n minus 1 category, treat it as an n category with one object. Everybody's symmetric monoidal. So now that's not quite semi-simple. It's not quite Karubi complete. So you Karubi complete it. So it's also like Karubi completing of the one object delooping. You know what this is in ordinary algebra. That's the thing that takes a ring and returns the category of finitely generated projective modules. In just from zero to one categories, if I had a commutative ring, that's like a zero category. If I take its one object delooping and then Karubi complete, I get the category of finitely generated projective modules. So this suspension is the same as like finitely generated projective modules. That's how I want you to think of it. Okay, so what you can do, we know that the loops, we know what the loop space of this higher category is. Now, if you had a space and if you take its loops and then sort of resuspend, well, the whole space includes the suspension of its loop space and sort of includes fully faithfully. So all that we really have to do is understand this extension problem. All we need to do. Let me call it sort of is understand this extension. And then there's a lemma that I did with Matthew Yu. Which holds in much more generality, but in this case tells you, so this is like the connected component of this whole disconnected space. The lemma says that the components of this space is just a group, an abelian group. And so this is really what a fusion category theorist would tell you is a G-graded extension. So it's some abelian group. So this is this extension, sigma vn minus 1 into v, vn, is some kind of G-graded extension. And Edinghoff, Nikshik, and Ostrich give very powerful tools for calculating G-graded extensions and making that calculation part of homotopy theory. Whatever group this is that we still have to work out. Sorry, I mean the following. I have some extension problem. Here's some fusion n category. Here's a sub n category. Now, in general, extension problems are hard. A G-graded extension, well, what you could do is you could take the larger thing. You can always decompose it as a sum of modules over the smaller thing. That decomposition is just this connected components decomposition because the smaller thing is the identity component. So you can always decompose the extension as a sum of modules. Now, the indexing, the grading of that decomposition might not be a group. The products in two modules might, like there might be multiplicity in the fusion coefficients. What I'm telling you is that in fact, the multiplicity is not, there's no, that all fusions occur with multiplicity one. So you take two simples and you fuse them and it's again simple. So it really is an extension by some group. So this is some G-graded extension. And adding off Nikshik and Ostrich will tell you that G-graded extensions, these are classified by maps, by maps of spectra from this is, and G is some abelian group. So you can take the, let me call it not G, let me call it A, because it's really an abelian group. And let me erase that over there because it's, I said it already. So these are classified by maps of spectra from the Eilenberg-MacLane spectrum of the grading group to the group of units inside the suspension of the subalgebra. So this we basically, we know by induction. And to get V, to actually get the nth algebraically closed category, we need the universal abelian group A like this. And so that's the calculation that you can try to do. Well, we understand this very well. In particular, well, this almost looks like the dual to spheres, except for in the bottom couple degrees. So you really can calculate it. So how does this look? Well, this guy looks like the dual to spheres. Except in the bottom 2 degrees. In kind of in pi 0 and pi 1. And so we win if we can work out the bottom 2 degrees. And I'm out of time, so I don't really get to tell you how to do this. But this actually just turns out to be a problem of classifying anomalous topological field theories. This is the same as counting the anomalous ND QFTs, TQFTs. And this is basically something that Lan Kong and Wen give a strategy for doing this. That I don't have time to explain, but if you're a topologist, their strategy is basically dual to surgery theory. The way the Lan Kong and Wen strategy for classifying topological field theories goes is they say, take a topological field theory, look at its sort of look at its operators of dimension less than half. That'll be commutative. Condense it out. And then end up with something that looks trivial. In topology, that translates to take a manifold, look at its homology in degrees less than half. Condensing out the operators is dual to attaching some cells to the manifold or doing surgery to those low homology classes. And you end up with something that looks basically like a sphere. So anyway, the punchline is that we can exactly calculate these. And I'm going to just jump to the end. And I've sort of given you a hint that the calculation, this calculation feels like doing surgery theory. So it feels like basically L theory. So jumping to the end, you find the following things. I'll just tell you some facts. Here's some things that you learn from doing these calculations. Well, the first fact that you learn, if you take just sort of V, so if you take N, so remember that the invertibles in Vn, this was the dual to spheres. So these were n-dimensional framed Bordism invariants. And these were also, you could think of as these were n-dimensional invertible TFTs. You could ask which of those are in the identity component. So these are the n-dimensional invertible TFTs which admit a gapped boundary, a topological boundary condition. And what you find out from the calculations that these are precisely the NDTFTs, which vanish, whose partition function vanishes on possibly exotic on all possibly exotic N spheres. And if you've heard of the J homomorphism, that's showing up here. The J homomorphism is what picks out the standard N spheres among all manifolds. And these are the possibly exotic ones. And you learn a few more things. And in particular, what you learn is that the Galois group of the extension kind of N sort of the sort of absolute Galois group, the Galois group of V of this algebraically closed object over K, is basically the group of, it's the group that's called PL. So it's the group of piecewise linear automorphisms of spheres. And I'm sure I'm out of time. Let me just mention that PL is a thing which interpolates between the orthogonal group and the sphere spectrum, factoring the J homomorphism. So, sorry? Yeah, I said approximately, except for in degree zero where you see the Galois group of K. Here, I just put it over K bar. So, no, it's a totally algebraic problem as long as I'm in characteristic zero. In positive characteristic, I'd rather not speculate. It's not quite this. There's one correction, which is that, so the corrections to this are, pi zero of the Galois group is the usual Galois group. If I did this over sort of whatever ground field, then I would get pi zero is just the Galois group of the algebraic, of the usual Galois group. That's one correction. And then the other correction is that if you look at kind of the kernel of the J homomorphism, the kernel of the J homomorphism has a bunch of Zs every fourth degree. And it's also true that the kernel of this homomorphism has a bunch of Zs every fourth degree. These are calculated by L theory. So the Zs in kind of the kernel of PL to spheres get replaced by a certain Witt group. And I'm out of time, so I'm not going to tell you which one they get replaced by. But that's what I wanted. That's what I've been thinking about for the last year or so. So thank you for your attention. And I would really like kind of comments and feedback, which is very much in progress. So. Sorry, I can't. Yeah. Great, so now I'm remembering I'm supposed to repeat questions. So online audience, I'm sorry, you didn't hear any of what Sasha asked me during the talk. Kevin's asking me, can I say how this fits in with unitarity and spin statistics? And it's a really good question, and of course it's what I would like to do. It's one of the reasons, what I'd like to do next or after this. For many years now, I had been hoping that the Galois group would be O infinity, and it's just not. I was wrong about that. I think I've certainly, you know, I've been hoping that it was this. It can't be this. It has to be, the best thing it would be is PL. And the reason why PL is a much better guess than the orthogonal group is actually that Lurie makes a comment. Let me actually, before I answer Kevin's question, I'm sort of collecting my thoughts, so I'm going to say something else along the way. And then I'll try to say what I think should be true. So, let me make a couple comments. So Lurie makes the following remark. In his TFT paper. He just sort of says, it's like one of these annoying remarks where he tells you what's true, but he doesn't tell you a clue why it's true, and just says, this is much too hard, and I'm not going to explain it in the paper. And so that's the only reference I have for this remark. So a result that was too hard for Lurie to include in his TFT's paper says that PLN, so PL infinity is, of course, the union of the PLN pieces. And he says that PLN is the automorphism group of Bord N. I had always actually thought the automorphism group was ON, but it's not. It's PLN. And the usual action that we think about in topological field theory that has ON, we normally, in topological field theory, like to study the ON fixed points of functors out of Bord N, because that's like getting kind of, that would get you down to, say, oriented or SO or whatever unoriented topological field theories. The ON action actually factors through PL. So any construction that only sees topological field theory has to work through PL. So that's not answering Kevin's question. But it does at least explain why my guess of the orthogonal group couldn't have been correct. Now, Kevin was asking about unitarity and so on. So there's a sort of weird feature. There's one weird trick. Which is, I told you the Galois group over any field of characteristic zero. And I told you that in degree zero, it was the ordinary Galois group. And after that, it really is just the sort of thing in homotopy theory with some weight groups and so on, but it's a purely algebraic problem. It's a problem of surgery theory. And there's this one weird trick, which is See, if you worked over R, the Galois group over R, just the zero categorical Galois group, this is just complex numbers. So this is just Z mod 2, which is exactly pi 0 of PL, or it's pi 0 of O, or whatever you want to use it as. Actually, let me also mention, PL and O, the difference between PL and O is the difference of exotic smooth structure. That's the difference between these. There's all sorts of weird stuff going on in dimension 4. Let me ignore it, because there's like people, we don't really understand smooth structure in dimension 4. The next place exotic smooth structure appears is in Milner's 7 spheres. And other than the really weird stuff in dimension 4, all the rest of the exotic stuff, of exotic smooth structure that shows up in this difference, is exotic spheres. Because exotic spheres start in dimension 7, this is an equivalence in dimensions less than about 7. You just won't see the difference until you get to dimension 8, I think. So it's like, that's why another reason I didn't see it. Right. So there's this one weird trick, which is that the Galois group, the algebraic Galois group matches this sort of, there's this sort of exceptional isomorphism between the algebraic, this sort of complex conjugation thing, and this thing that comes from invertible field theories. And so now what you could do is you can do the following. So you could sort of say, like, so what you have, if you look at say functors, say look at framed TFTs, so functors from board N, say framed board N into VN. So this is, of course, just the objects of this group of objects of Vn by the cohortism hypothesis. Well, here you have an action by PL infinity. Well, by something which is almost PL infinity. It's not quite, it's off by some little replacements, but it's almost PL infinity. Here you have an action by PL infinity itself, or by PLn. I told you that board N is PLN. And although the constructions work out so that these actions kind of agree, you can ask for, say, fixed points of this action, or fixed points of this action, or fixed points of the diagonal. And because of this weird trick means that this is actually correct in degree 0 as well. So using the weird trick, it's interesting to ask, this sort of says you could ask, you could say that a field theory, a TFT, is maybe, I don't know what to call it quite, maybe let's call it Hermitian. If it's fixed by the diagonal PL action. Diagonal PLN action. So if it intertwines the PL action here with the PL action here. Which is extra data. I mean, that's like a Hermitian structure. And in particular, I want to intertwine this Z mod 2. And now I really want to work with sort of the version over the real numbers. So in particular, I want to intertwine this Z mod 2 with the Z mod 2 of orientation reversal. That's the one place where this story just didn't give you any reason to identify them, because this was a totally algebraic thing. That's a good notion. I don't know how many Hermitian field theories there are. This is extra data on the field theory. There's probably no uniqueness. Some Hermitian structures should be positive or reflection positive. And what I'd love to have, I think it's true that once you have a Hermitian structure, you can start asking questions about is it positive. And I think it's true that, well, anyway, that's something I don't have any updates for you, Kevin, on. But for the rest of the audience, sort of, I think like you could ask if a Hermitian structure is positive. That's basically a reflection positivity condition on the TFT. And it would be reasonable to conjecture, as I said, there's a space of Hermitian structures. If you have a Hermitian structure, among other things, it gives you sesquilinear pairings on all of the vector spaces of manifolds of dimension n minus 1, for example. So there's really a space of these structures. It's really a scheme, I mean, some sort of algebraic space. But the conjecture is that in the R topology, so there's some scheme of these, but I'm over R, so I can talk about the R points of this scheme, and I can ask about its topology as an analytic topology. And the conjecture would be that in the R topology, I don't even know if you can see this, I think the podium's in the way. In the R topology, the set of positive Hermitian structures should be contractible. there's essentially a unique one. I don't know if this, I don't really have, that's a conjecture. I don't know, I don't, it's true in low dimensions where I can compute, but, you know, I mean, it looks true, but, you know, once you get to, like, once you start hitting exotic spheres, then I'm not gonna, I don't wanna put money on it. Yeah. So I think that there's this rate. So David, so there are two answers. So David asked for those in sort of online for me to comment on what this has to say about whether TFTs can see exotic smooth structure. And I think, including me, people have a kind of what turns out is a wrong idea of what the state of the art on that type of thing is. So the first thing to say is that four-dimensional topology is just radically different from any other dimension. So I kind of would rather not, like, so in particular, I said the Zs here get replaced by a certain Witt group. And actually, all of them get replaced by the same Witt group except for the bottom Z, which gets replaced by the quantum Witt group of modular tensor categories. That's probably a feature of where kind of 4D theory gets really different. And another feature is that in four dimensions, there aren't any exotic spheres in dimension three or four. All spheres are standard, and yet there's exotic RNs. The four-dimensional exotic topology is, exotic differential geometry is just different. And I don't have much to say. No, I don't think that that sort of semi-simple TFTs are going to see much about four-dimensional differential sort of exotic differential geometry. On the other hand, it's just not true that they can't see exotic structure at all. People like me thought, like I actually had learned that this fact, this quote fact, that 4D TFTs, that semi-simple 4D TFTs like this don't see exotic structure, and it's just false. It's true for oriented TFTs. Don't see exotic smooth structure on oriented manifolds. But pin TFTs can see exotic smooth pin manifolds. So it turns out that last, like if you ask sort of, if you have two manifolds which are two four manifolds that differ by their smooth structure but have the same homeomorphism type, they can have different pin invariant. They can both be pinnable, but with different pin, different values for pin TFTs. And you can even write down state sum models that see smooth, that see the difference of smooth structures for pin manifolds in 4D. So I think that already gives you evidence that actually in sort of semi-simple TFT can see smooth structures. More to the point, well, I don't know, it's somehow circular. What ends up happening, I told you what the Galois group is. What do I mean by a Galois group? Well, if you have a field extension, if you have a Galois extension of fields, the sort of larger field in that field extension, it's sort of, its different directions are basically indexed by the elements of the Galois group. If you think about the inclusion of, of the real numbers into the complex numbers, the imaginary direction kind of is the part that's charged under complex conjugation. And the same thing's true here. So telling you this Galois group is basically telling you all the things you have to add to build the next algebraic closure, all the new TFTs you have to add in. And well, you have to add some pieces that look like the orthogonal group, but those you understand. And basically this, like if you look at sort of what does PL infinity look like, it looks like the orthogonal group plus some exotic spheres. So yeah, so the answer is I'm giving you TFTs that can see exotic spheres, but I'm just doing it by hand. I'm just handing them to you. I did tell you a theorem here. If you have an n-dimensional invertible TFT which sees exotic spheres, then it does not have a topological boundary condition. And this is if and only if. In particular, no state sum model. No. And I think this is, I'm pretty sure this is exactly characterizing the TFTs that have a state sum model. Well, thank you. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Probably. I don't know anything. OK, it's unknown to me. Ben asked, isn't it unknown about exotic spheres in dimension 4? I don't know. It's unknown to me. Yeah, I should have. Yeah, so. Yeah, so the Zs, I should have said, the Z, there were three corrections. Something going on in dimension 0, something going on with the Zs in the kernel of this map, and then like, something worse in, well, I've indexed it by the group, so it's basically pi 3 of the Galois group, where basically I'm going to bury any question about four-dimensional smooth geometry gets ended up absorbed. Well, and what it actually is, it's not that bad. I can tell you exactly what the group is. I can tell you, like, I can tell it to you, like, up to sort of, you know, I can tell you really exactly what group you get, and it doesn't see a lot of smooth geometry. It sees a little bit, as we were discussing with Davide. I'm sure that there are questions about smooth manifolds in dimension 4 that semi-simple TFTs cannot answer. So it's not much worse, but it does have sort of at least some of this weirdness in dimension 4 shows up there.